Mason and Dixon, Part 1, by Thomas Pynchon. For Melanie and for Jackson. Part 1, Latitudes and Departures. Chapter 1. Snowballs have flown their arcs, starred the sides of outbuildings as of cousins, carried hats away into the brisk wind off Delaware. The sleds are brought in and their runners carefully dried and greased, shoes deposited in the back hall, a stockinged foot descent made upon the great kitchen, in a purposeful dither since morning, punctuated by the ringing lids of various boilers and stewing pots, fragrant with pie spices, peeled fruits, suet, heated sugar. The children, having all upon the fly, among rhythmic slaps of batter and spoon, coaxed and stolen what they might, proceed, as upon each afternoon all this snowy advent, to a comfortable room at the rear of the house, years since given over to their carefree assaults. Here have come to rest a long, scarred sawbuck table with two mismatched side benches from the Lancaster County branch of the family. Some Second Street Chippendale, including an interpretation of the famed Chinese sofa, with a high canopy of yards of purple stuff that might be drawn all round to make a snug, dim tent. A few odd chairs sent from England before the war, mostly pine and cherry about, nor much mahogany, excepting a sinister and wonderful card table which exhibits the cheaper wave-like grain known in the trade as wandering heart, causing an illusion of depth into which for years children have gazed as into the illustrated pages of books. Along with so many hinges, sliding mortises, hidden catches, and secret compartments that neither the twins nor their sister can say they have been to the end of it. Upon the wall, banished to this den of parlor apes for its remembrance of a time better forgotten, reflecting most of the room, the carpet and drapes a little frayed, Whiskers the cat stalking beneath the furniture, looking out with eyes finely reflexive to anything suggesting food, hangs a mirror in an inscribed frame commemorating the Mischianza, that memorable farewell ball staged in 77 by the British who'd been occupying the city just before their withdrawal from Philadelphia. This Christmastide of 1786, with the war settled and the nation bickering itself into fragments, wounds bodily and ghostly, great and small, go aching on, not everyone commemorated, nor too often even recounted. Snow lies upon all Philadelphia, from river to river, whose further shores have so vanished behind curtains of ice fog that the city today might be an isle upon an ocean. Ponds and creeks are frozen over, and the trees aglare to the last slightest twig, nerve lines of concentrated light. Hammers and saws have fallen still. Bricks lie in snow-covered heaps. City sparrows, in speckled outbursts, hop in and out of what shelter there may be. The nightward sky, clouds blown to chalk smears, stretches above the northern liberties, Spring Garden and Germantown, its early moon pale as the snowdrifts. Smoke ascends from chimney pots, sledging parties adjourn indoors, taverns bustle. Freshly infused coffee flows every place, borne about through rooms front and back, whilst Madeira, which has ever fueled association in these parts, is deployed nowadays like an ancient elixir upon the seething pot of politics. For the times are as impossible to calculate this advent as the distance to a star. It has become an afternoon habit for the twins and their sister, and what friends, old and young, may find their way here, to gather for another tale from their far-traveled uncle, the Reverend Wicks Cherrycoke, who arrived here back in October for the funeral of a friend of years ago, too late for the burial, as it proved, and has lingered as a guest in the home of his sister Elizabeth, the wife for many years of Mr. J. Wade Lespark, a respected merchant active in town affairs, whilst in his home yet sultan enough to convey to the Reverend, though without ever so stipulating, that for as long as he can keep the children amused, he may remain. Too much evidence of juvenile rampage at the wrong moment, however, and boppo, 'twill be out the door with him, where waits the winter's block and blade. Thus they have heard the escape from Hottentot land, the accursed ruby of Mogok, the shipwrecks in Indies east and west, an Herodotic web of adventures and curiosities selected, the Reverend implies, for their moral usefulness, whilst avoiding others not as suitable in the hearing of youth. The youth, as usual, not being consulted in this. Tenebrae has seated herself and taken up her needlework, a piece whose size and difficulty are already subjects of discussion in the house, the embroideress herself keeping silence, upon this topic at least. announced by nasal telegraph, in come the twins, bearing the old pewter coffee machine, venting its puffs of vapor, and a large basket dedicated to sacromantic appetites, piled to the brim with fresh fried doughnuts rolled in sugar, glazed chestnuts, buns, fritters, crullers, tarts. What is this? Why, lads, you read my mind. The coffee's for you, Nunk. Last time you were talking in your sleep, the pair explain, placing the sweets nearer themselves, all in this room being left to seize and pour as they may. As none could agree which had been born first, the twins were named Pitt and Pliny, so that each might be termed the elder or the younger, as might day to day please one or annoy his brother. Why haven't we heard a tale about America? Pitt, licking gobbets of Philadelphia pudding from his best jabot. With Indians in it, and Frenchmen, adds Pliny, whose least gesture sends cookie crumbs everywhere. French women, come to that, mutters Pitt. It's not easy being pious for both of us, you know, Pliny advises. It's 20 years, recalls the Reverend, since we all topped the Allegheny Ridge together and stood looking out at the Ohio country, so fair, a revelation, meadowed to the horizon. Mason and Dixon and all the McLeans, Darby and Cope, no, Darby wouldn't have been there in 66. Howbeit, old Mr. Barnes and young Tom Hines, the rascal, don't know where they all went. Some fought in the war, some chose peace, come what might, some profited, some lost everything. Some are gone to Kentucky, and some, as now poor Mason, to dust. 'Twas not too many years before the war. What we were doing out in that country together was brave, scientific beyond my understanding, and ultimately meaningless. We were putting a line straight through the heart of the wilderness, 8 yards wide and due west, in order to separate two proprietorships, granted when the world was yet feudal, and but 8 years later to be nullified by the war for independence. And now Mason's gone, and the Reverend Cherry Coke, who came to town only to pay his respects, has lingered. Through the first descent of cold, the first drawings in to the hearthside, the first harvest season meals appearing on the next best dishes. He had intended to be gone weeks ago, but finds he cannot detach. Each day among his devoirs is a visit, however brief, to Mason's grave. The verger has taken to nodding at him. In the middle of the night recently, he awoke, convinced that 'twas he who had been haunting Mason, that, like a shade with a grievance, he expected Mason, but newly arrived at death, to help him with something. After years wasted, the Reverend commences, at perfecting a parsonical disguise, grown old in the service of an impersonation that never took more than a handful of actor's tricks, past remembering those yearnings for danger, past all that ought to have been, but never had a hope of becoming, have I beached upon these Republican shores. Stoven, dismasted, imbecile with age, an untrustworthy remembrancer for whom the few events yet rattling within a broken memory must provide the only comfort now remaining to him. Uncle, Tenebrae pretends to gasp, but this morning you looked so much younger. Why, I'd no idea. Kindly, Bree, that is from my secret relation, of course. Don't know that I'd phrase it quite like that in the present company. Then, Tenebrae replying to her uncle's twinkling with the usual play of eyelashes, it begins with a hanging. Excellent, cry the twins. The Reverend, producing a scarred old notebook covered in cheap leather, begins to read. Had I been the first churchman of modern times to be swung from Tyburn Tree, had I been then taken for dead, whilst in fact but spending an intermission among the eventless corridors of syncope due to the final bowl of ale, had a riotous throng of medical students taken what they deemed to be my cadaver back beneath the somber groins of their college, had I then been resurrected into an entirely new knowledge of the terms of being in which our Savior, strange to say in that era of Wesley and Whitefield, though present, would not have figured as preeminently as with most sectarians, albeit I should closely resemble the nomadic parson you behold today. Mother says you're the family outcast, Pitt remarks. They pay you money to keep away, says Pliny. Your grandsire Cherry Coke, lads, has ever kept his promise to remit to me, by way of certain chartered companies, a sum precise to the farthing and punctual as the moon, to any address in the world, save one in Britain. Britain is his world, and he will persist, even now, in standing shamed before it for certain crimes of my distant youth." "Crimes!" exclaimed the boys together. "Why, so did wicked men declare 'em. Before God, another tale." "What did they nail you on?" Uncle Ives wishes to know. "Strictly professional interest, of course." Green, brief bag over one shoulder, but lately returned from a coffee house meeting, he is bound later this evening for a slightly more formal version of the same thing. Feeling, here with the children, much as might a coaching passenger let off at nightfall among an unknown populace to wait for a connecting coach, alone, pedestrian, desiring to pass the time to some revenue, if not profit. "Along with some lesser counts," the Reverend is replying, "'twas one of the least tolerable of offenses in that era, the worst of Dick Turpin seeming, but the carelessness of youth beside it, the crime they styled anonymity. That is, I left messages posted publicly, but did not sign them. I knew some night-running lads in the district who let me use their printing press. Somehow, what I got into printing up were accounts of certain crimes I had observed, committed by the stronger against the weaker. Enclosures, evictions, assize verdicts, activities of the military, giving the names of as many of the perpetrators as I was sure of, yet keeping back what I foolishly imagined my own till the night I was tipped and brought into London in chains and clapped in the Tower. The Tower? Oh, do not tease them so," Tenebry prays him. "Ludgate, then, whichever, 'twas jail. It took me till I was lying among the rats and vermin, upon the freezing edge of a future invisible, to understand that my name had never been my own, rather belonging all this time to the authorities, who forbade me to change it or withhold it, as 'twere a ring upon the collar of a beast, ever waiting for the lead to be fastened on. One of those moments Hindus and Chinamen are ever said to be having, entire loss of self, perfect union with all, sort of thing. Strange lights, fires, voices indecipherable. Indeed, children, this is the part of the tale where your old uncle gets to go insane, or so then each in his interest did it please everyone to style me. Sea voyages in those days being the standard treatment for insanity, my exile should commence for the best of medical reasons. Though my inclination had been to go out aboard an East Indiaman," the Reverend continues, "as that route east traversed notoriously a lively and youthful world of shipboard dalliance, gale force assemblies, and duels ashore, with the French fleet a constant, for some romantic danger, like pirates yet more polite, as the ladies often assured me, alas, those who controlled my fate, getting wind of my preference at the last moment, swiftly arranged to have me transferred into a small British frigate, sailing alone, upon a long voyage in a time of war. The Seahorse, 24 guns, Captain Smith. I hastened in to Leadenhall Street to inquire. 'Can this be objection, we hear?' I was greeted. 'Are you saying that a sixth rate is beneath you? Would you prefer to remain ashore and take up quarters in Bedlam? It has made a man of many in your situation. Some have come to enjoy fairly meaningful lives there. Or if it's some need for the exotic, we might arrange for a stay in one of the French hospitals. Would one of my condition even know how to object, my lord? I owe you everything.' 'Madness has not impaired your memory. Good. Keep away from harmful substances, in particular coffee, tobacco, and Indian hemp. If you must use the latter, do not inhale. Keep your memory working, young man. Have a safe voyage.'" So, with this no doubt well-meant advice finding its way into the mid-watch sounds of waves past my sleeping place, I set sail upon an engine of destruction, in the hope that eastward yet might dwell something of peace and Godhead, which British civilization, in venturing westward, had left behind. And thus was consternation the least of my feelings, when, instead of supernatural guidance from Lamas, old as time, here came Jean Crapaud a-looming. 34 guns worth of disaster, and only one lesson. Chapter 2. To Mr. Mason, Assistant to the Astronomer Royal at Greenwich. Esteemed Sir, as I have the honor of being named your second upon the proposed expedition to Sumatra to observe the transit of Venus, I hope I do not err in introducing myself thus. Despite what reassurances you may have had from Mr. Bird and Mr. Emerson, and I hope others, as to my suitability, Yet, yourself being adjunct to the prime astronomer of the kingdom, 'twould be strange, not odd, of course, but unexpected, rather, if you did not entertain a professional doubt, or even two, as to my qualifications. Though 'tis true that in my own work I have recourse much more often to the needle than to the stars, yet what I lack in celestial experience, I pray I may counterpend with diligence and a swift grasp. As clearly I cannot pretend to your level of art, sir, gladly would I adopt, as promptly as benefit from, any suggestions you might direct toward improving the level of my own. In this, as in all else, your obedient servant, Jeremiah Dixon. A few months later, when it is no longer necessary to pretend as much as they expected they'd have to, Dixon reveals that whilst composing this, he had deliberately refrained from drink. Went through 20 revisions, dreaming all the while of the pint awaiting me down at the Jolly Pitman. Then the pint after that, of course, and so forth, growing more desirable with each stricken phrase, if thou follow me. Mason, in turn, confesses to having nearly thrown the letter away, having noted its origin in County Durham, and assumed it to be but more of the free provincial advice that it was one of his tasks to read through in the Astronomer Royal's behalf, and respond to. Yet 'twas so sincere, I instantly felt shamed, unworthy, that this honest country soul believed me wise. Ah, bitter deception. To Mr. Jeremiah Dixon, Bishop Auckland County, Durham. Sir, I have yours of the 26th ultimo, and am much obliged for your kind opinion. Yet I fear the doubts may with justice fall more upon your side, for I have never taught anyone, upon any subject, nor may I prove much skilled at it. Howbeit, pray you hesitate not in asking what you like, as I shall ever try to answer honestly, if probably not in toto. Each of us is to have his own twin telescope by Mr. Dolland, fitted with the latest of his marvelous achromatics, our clock by Mr. Ellicott, and of course the sector by your Mr. Bird. None but the best for this party, I should say. Wishing you a journey south as safe as his ways, how strange, may allow, I await your arrival in a spirit happily rescued by your universally good name from all imps of the apprehensive, an exception most welcome in the generally uneasy life of your obedient servant, Charles Mason. Chapter 3. I was not there when they met, or not in the usual way. I later heard from them how they remembered meeting. I tried to record, in what I then projected as a sort of spiritual daybook, what I could remember of what they said, though 'twas too often abridged by the day's fatigue. "Writing in your sleep, too," cry the twins. Oh, children, I even dreamed in those days, but only long after the waking traverse was done. Howsobeit, scarcely have they met, in the saloon of Mason's Inn at Portsmouth, than Mason finds himself coming the old London hand, before Dixon's clear stupefaction with that town. A fellow was spitting at my shoes, another pushing folk one by one into the gutters, some of them quite dangerous to look at. How can ye dwell thus closely together, day upon day, without all growing murderous? Oh, one may, if one wishes, find insult at every step, from insolent stares to mortal assault, an orgy of insult uninterrupted. Yet how does one proceed to call out each offender in turn, or choose among them, and in obedience to what code? So one soon understands it, as yet another term in the contract between the city and oneself, a function of simple density, ensuring that there never be time enough to acknowledge, let alone to resent, such a mad variety of offered offense. Just so. Why, back in Bishop, it might take half the night to find an excuse to clash someone in the face, whilst in London, 'tis the paradise of the quarrelsome for fair. You'd appreciate Wapping High Street, then, and Tyburn, of course, put that on your list. Alluring out there, is it? Mason explains, though without his precise reason for it, that for the past year or more, it has been his practice to attend the Friday hangings at that melancholy place, where he was soon chatting up hangmen and their prentices, whilst standing them pints at their local, the Bridport Dagger, acquiring thus a certain grisly intimacy with the art. Mason has been shoved about and borne along in riots of sailors attempting to wrest from bands of medical students the bodies of shipmates come to grief ashore, too far from the safety of the sea, and he's had his purse, as his person assaulted by agents, public and private, And yet, there's nothing like it. It's London at its purest, he cries. You must come out there with me, soon as we may. Taking it for the joke, it must surely be, Dixon laughs. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, that's a bonny one, all right. Mason, shrugging, palms up. I'm serious. Worse than that, I'm sober. A man's first time in town, he simply can't miss a hanging. Come, sir, what's the first thing they'll ask when you get back to County Durham? Eh, did you see them ride the air at Tyburn? Is it too many nights alone on top of that famed hill in Greenwich? Can this man, living in one of the great cities of Christendom, not know how to behave around people? Dixon decides to register only annoyance. No, the first thing they'll ask is, did tho understand them the way they talk down there? Oh, dammy, I say, I didn't mean... So Dixon, for the second time in 2 minutes, finds himself laughing without the motrix of honest mirth. This time a Mr. Mason, how you do go on laugh, sidewise and forbearing, the laugh of a hired foil. Yet, feeling it his duty to set them at ease, he begins, Well, there's this Jesuit, this Corsican, and this Chinaman, and they're all riding in a great coach, going up to Bath. And the fourth passenger is a very proper Englishwoman, who keeps giving them these scandalized glances. Finally, able to bear it no longer, the Corsican, being the most hot-headed of the three, bursts out, and here I hope you will excuse my Corsican accent, he says, Hey, lady, what are you looking at? And she says, Mason has been edging away. Are you crazy? He whispers. People are staring. Sailors are staring. Eee, Dixon's nose throbbing redly. You have heard it, then. Apologies. Reaching to clasp Mason's arm, a gesture Mason retreats from in a flinch, as free of deliberation as a sneeze. Dixon, withdrawing, broken into a sweat. Why, aye, it took me weeks of study to fathom that one. But I see you've a brisk brain in your gourd there, and I'm pleased to be working with such as it be. Resolutely abeam, pronouncing the forms of you consciously, as if borrowing them from another tongue. The two are staring, one at the other, each with a greatly mistaken impression. Likewise, in some uncertainty as to how the power may come to be sorted out betwixt them. Dixon is a couple of inches taller, sloping more than towering, wearing a red coat of military cut with brocade and silver buttons, and a matching three-cornered hat with some gaudy North Road cockade stuck in it. He will be first to catch the average eye, often causing future strangers to remember them as Dixon and Mason. But the uniform accords with neither his Quaker profession nor his present bearing. A civilian slouch grown lopsided, too often observed, alas, in devotees of the taproom. For Dixon's part, he seems disappointed in Mason, or so the astronomer, ever inclined to suspicion, fears. What is it? What are you looking at? It's my wig, isn't it? You're not wearing a wig. Just so, you noted that. You have been observing me in a strange, yet, I must conclude, meaningful way. Don't know. Happen I was expecting someone a bit more odd. Mason, a squint. I'm not odd enough for you? Well, it is a peculiar station in life, isn't it? How many royal astronomers are there? How many royal astronomers' assistants are there likely to be? Takes an odd bird to stay up peering at stars all night in the first place, doesn't it? On the other hand, surveyors are running about numerous as bedbugs, and twice as cheap, with work enough for all, certainly in Durham at present. Enclosures all over the county and North Yorkshire, fences, hedges, ditches ordinary and ha-ha style, all to be laid out. I could have stayed home and had myself a fine living. They did mention a background in land surveying, Mason in some surprise, but that's it? Hedges? Ha-has? Well, actually, the Durham ha-ha boom subsided a bit after Lord Lambton fell into his, cursed it, had it filled in with coal spoil. Why, did you think I was another lens fellow? Oh, Lord, no. I mean, I've been taught the lot. Celestial mechanics, all the weighty lads, Laplace and Kepler, Aristarchus, the other fellow, what's his name? But that's all trigonometry, isn't it? Yet you, how shall he put this tactfully? You have looked, through a, Dixon smiles at him encouragingly. Why, I. My old teacher, Mr. Emerson, has a fine telescope, I believe is the word, encased in barrel staves, though it be. And many's the evening I've admired the phases of Venus, aye, those and the moons of Jupiter, too, the mountains and craters of our own moon. And you did see that latest eclipse. Canny, eh? Mr. Bird as well has shared his instruments. Being kind enough, in fact, just in this last fortnight to help me practice my observing and computing skills. Though so mercilessly that I was in doubt for days whether we'd parted friends. Mason, having expected some shambling wild country fool, remains amiably puzzled before the tidy Dixon here presented, who, for his own part, having despite talk of oddity expected but another overdressed London climber, is amused at Mason's nearly invisible turnout, all in snuffs and buffs and grays. Mason is nodding glumly. I must seem an ass. If this is as bad as it gets, why, I can abide that, as long as the spirits don't run out. Nor the wine. Wine? Dixon is now the one squinting. Mason wonders what he's done this time. Grape or grain, but never the twain, as me great Uncle George observed to me more than once. Vine with corn, beware the morn. Of the two sorts of drinking folk this implies, that is, grape people and grain people, you will now inform me of your membership in the Brotherhood of the Grape, and that you seldom, if ever, touch ale or spirits, am I correct? Happily so, I should imagine, as, given a finite supply, there'd be more for each of us. It's like Jack Sprat, isn't it? Oh, I'll drink wine if I must. And now we're entered upon the topic. And as we are in Portsmouth, after all, there cannot lie too distant some room where each of us may consult what former vegetation pleases him. Dixon looks outside at the ebbing wintry sunlight. Nor too early, I guess. We're sailing to the Indies. Heaven knows what's available on board or out there. It may be our last chance for civilized drink. Sooner we start, the better, in that case. As the day darkens and the first flames appear, sometimes reflected as well in panes of glass, the sounds of the stables and the alleys grow louder, and chimney smoke perambulates into the Christmastide air. The room puts on its evening cloak of shifting amber light and sinuous folds of shadow. Mason and Dixon become aware of a jostling murmur of expectancy. All at once, out of the murk, a dozen mirrored lanterns have leapt alight together, as into their glare now strolls a somewhat disheveled Norfolk terrier, with a raffish gleam in its eye, whilst from somewhere less illuminate comes a sprightly overture upon horn, clarinet, and cello, in time to which the dog steps back and forth in his bright ambit. Ask me anything you please. The learned English dog am I, well upon everything from fleas unto the king's monogamy. Persian princes, Polish blintzes, Chinaman's geomancy, jumping beans or flying machines, just as it suits your fancy. I quote enough of the classical stuff to set your ears athrob, work logarithmic versed signs with all within me knob, only nothing ministerial please, or I'm apt to lose my job, as the learned English dog tonight. There are the usual requests. Does the dog know where the bee sucks? What is the integral of 1 over book D book? Is he married? Dixon notes how his coadjutor-to-be seems fallen into a sort of magnetical stupor, as mesmerites might term it. More than once, Mason looks ready to leap to his feet and blurt something better kept till later in the evening. At last the dog recognizes him, though now he is too keyed up to speak with any coherence. After allowing him to rattle for a full minute, the dog sighs deeply. See me later, out in back. It shouldn't take but a moment, Mason tells Dixon. I'll be all right by myself, if there's something you'd rather be doing. With no appetite for the giant mutton chop cooling in front of him, Mason mopishly now wraps it and stows it in his coat. Looking up, he notes Dixon, mouth cheerfully stuffed, beaming too tolerantly for his comfort. No, not for me. Did you think I was taking it for myself? 'Tis for the learned dog, rather. Like, I don't know, perhaps a bouquet sent to an actress one admires. A nice chop can never go too far off the mark. Starting a beat late, why, aye, 'tis a great world for fare, and practices vary, and one man certainly may not comment upon... What? What are you saying? Dixon ingenuously waving his joint, eyes round as pistols. No offense, sir. Rolling his eyes the moment Mason switches his stare away, then back a bit late to catch them so much as off-center. Dixon, why mayn't there be oracles for us in our time? Gateways to futurity. That can't all have died with the ancient peoples. Isn't it worth looking ridiculous at least to investigate this English dog for its obvious bearing upon metempsychosis, if naught else? There is something else in progress, something Mason cannot quite confide. Happen he's lost someone close, and recently enough to matter, aye, for he's a way of pitching ever into the hour, heedless as Dixon remembers himself after his father passed on. I'll come along, if I may. Suit yourself, as the medical students like to say. They go out a back door, into the inn yard. A leafless tree arches into the light of a single lanthorn set above a taut gathering of card players. Their secret breathing visible for all to try to read, and wigs, white as the snow on the roof slates, nodding in and out of the shadows. Sailors, mouths ajar, lope by in the lanes. Sailors in slouch hats, sailors with queues, puffing on pipes, eating potatoes. Some who'll be going back to the ship, and some who won't. From old sea wretches with too many explosions in their lives, to child midshipmen who have yet to hear their first. Passing in and out the doors of ale drapers, naval tailors, sweet shops, gaming lairs, upstart chapels, calling, singing catches, whistling as if wind had never paid a visit, vomiting as the sea has never caused them to. Happen his dressing room's close by, Dixon suggests. In with the horses, maybe. No one would keep a talking dog in with horses. It'd drive them mad inside of a minute. Occurs often, does it, where you come from? Gentlemen, in a whisper out of a dark corner, if you'll keep your voices down, I'll be with you in a trice. Slowly, into their shifting spill of lantern light, tongue alaw, comes the dog, who pauses to yawn, nods good evening to ye, and leads them at a trot out of the stables, out of the courtyard, and down the street, pausing now and then for nasal inquiries. Where are we going? Mason asks. This seems to be all right. The learned English dog stops and pisses. This dog, Mason, singing sotto voce, is causing me apprehension. Surely creatures of miracle ought not to, I mean, flying horses, none of them ever. The Sphinx, adds Dixon. My thought precisely. Now, gents, 'tis a sudden, large son of Neptune, backed by an uncertain number of comparably drunken shipmates. You've an interest in this dog here? Wished a word with him only, Mason's quick to assure them. Hey, I know you two. You're the ones with all the strange machinery, sailing in the Seahorse. Well, you're in luck, for we're all seahorses here. I'm Fenderbelly Bodine, captain of the foretop, and these are my mates. Cheering. But you can call me Fender. Now, our plan is to snatch this critter, and for you gents to then keep it with your own highly guarded cargo, out of sight of the master-at-arms until we reach a likely island. Island? Snatch? Both surveyors a bit in a daze. I've been out more than once to the Indies. There's a million islands out there, each more likely than the last. And I tell you, a handful of sailors with their wits about them, and that talking dog to keep the savages amused, why, we could be kings. Long life to kings, cry several sailors. Aye, and to cooch girls, and coconut ale. Old, cautions Mason, I've heard they eat dogs out there. Wrap 'em in palm leaves, Dixon solemnly, and bake 'em on the beach. First time you turn your back, Mason warns, that dog's going to be some savage's luncheon. Ugh, excuse me, says the learned dog. As I seem to be the topic here, I do feel impelled to make an observation. That's all right, then, Fido. Bodine, making vague petting motions, trust us, there's a good bow-wow. A small, noisy party of fops, macaronis, or lunarians, it is difficult quite to distinguish which, has been working its way up the street and into earshot. Through several window panes, moving candlelight appears. Hostlers roll about disgruntled upon feed sack pillows and beds. Unengaged glimjacks look in to see if they can cast any light on matters. The dog pushes Mason's leg with his head. We may not have another chance to chat, even upon the fly. There is something I must know, Mason hoarsely whispers, in the tone of a lover tormented by doubts. Have you a soul? That is, are you a human spirit, reincarnate as a dog? The LED blinks, shivers, nods in a resigned way. You are hardly the first to ask. Travelers returned from the Japanese islands tell of certain religious puzzles known as koan, perhaps the most famed of which concerns your very question, whether a dog hath the nature of the divine Buddha. A reply given by a certain very wise master is mu. Mu, repeats Mason thoughtfully. It is necessary for the seeker to meditate upon the koan until driven to a state of holy insanity, and I would recommend this to you in particular. But please do not come to the learned English dog if it's religious comfort you're after. I may be preternatural, but I am not supernatural. 'Tis the age of reason. Ruff. There is ever an explanation at hand, and no such thing as a talking dog. Talking dogs belong with dragons and unicorns. What there are, however, are provisions for survival in a world less fantastic. Namely, once the only reason men kept dogs was for food. Noting that among men no crime was quite so abhorred as eating the flesh of another human, dog quickly learned to act as human as possible, and to pass this ability on from parents to pups. So we know how to evoke from you, man, one day at a time, at least enough mercy for one day more of life. Nonetheless, however accomplished, our lives are never settled. We go on as tail-wagging Scheherazades, ever a step away from the dread palm leaf, nightly delaying the blades of our masters by telling back to them tales of their humanity. I am but an extreme expression of this process. Oh, I say, dog in palm leaf, what nonsense, comments one of the Lunarians. Really, far too sensitive. I mean, really, dog in palm leaf? Civilized humans have better things to do than go about drooling after dog and palm leaf or whatever, don't we, Algernon? Could you possibly, inquired the terrier, head cocked in some annoyance, not keep saying that? I do not say things like macaroni Italian style, do I, nor fop fricassee? Why, you beastly little grrr, and your deliberate use of drooling, sir, is vile. The Lunarian reaches for his hanger. Perhaps we may settle this upon the spot, sir. Derek, you're talking to a D.O.G.? Though your weapon put me under some handicap, points out the dog, in fairness, I should mention my late feelings of aversion to water, which may, as you know, signal the onset of the hydrophobia. Yes, the great H. And should I get in past your blade for a few playful nips and manage to, well, break the old skin, why, then you should soon have caught the same, eh? Immediately, round the dog develops a circle of absence of about a fathom's radius, later recalled by both astronomers as remarkably regular in shape. Nice doggie. Here, me last iced cake that me mum sent me all the way from Bath. You take it. What think ye's? I'll give 2-1 the fop's blood'll be the first to show. Sounds fair, says Fender Bodine. I fancy the dog. Anyone else? Oughtn't we to summon the owners, suggests Mr. Dixon. The dog has begun to pace back and forth. I am a British dog, sir. No one owns me. Who are the gentleman and lady who were with you in the assembly room? Inquires Mason. You mean the fabulous Jellos? Here they come now. Protect you from sailors, wails Mrs. Jello, approaching at a dead run over the treacherous cobbles of the lane. Oh, no, thank you. That was not in our agreement. Her husband, pulling on his breeches, wig, a lop, follows at a sleepy amble. Now you apologize for whatever it was you did, and get back in that stable in your lovely straw bed. We were wondering, ma'am, Bodine with his hat off, quavering angelically, would the little doggie be for sale? Not at any price, top man, and be off with you, and your rowdy, dowing flock as well. At her voice, a number of sailors in whose flexibility lies their preservation from the hazards of drink are seen to freeze. Do not oppose her, Jello advises, for she is a first rate of 100 guns and her broadside is annihilation. Thank ye, Jello. Slow again, I see. Oh, dear, Bodine putting his hat back on and sighing. Apologies, sir and madam, and much happiness of your dog. You are the owners of this marvel? Inquires Mason. We prefer exhibitors, says Mr. Jello. Damn ye, they'd better, grumps the dog as if to himself. Why, here is the Pearl of Sumatra, calls Dixon, who for some while has been growing increasingly desperate for a drink, and a jolly place it seems. Fenderbelly is buying, shouts some mischievous sailor, forever unidentified amid the eager rush for the entry of this fifth or sixth most notorious sailor's haunt upon the point, even in whose climate of general iniquity the Pearl distinguishes itself, much as might one of its eponyms, shining midst the decadent flesh of some oyster taken from the southern sea. How about a slug into your bread room there, Fido? Pray you, call me Fang. Well, and yes, I do like a drop of roll me in the kennel now and then. Inside, seamen of all ranks and ratings mill slowly in a murk of pipe smoke and soot from cheap candles, whilst counter-swirling go a choice assortment of Portsmouth Falls and striped and floral gowns, whose bold reds, oranges, and purples are taken down in this light, bruised, made oily and worn, with black mixed in everywhere, colors turning ever toward night. Both gentlemen note, after a while, that the net motion of the company is away from the street doors and toward the back of the establishment, where, upon a length of turf fertilized with the blood and the droppings of generations of male poultry, beneath a bright inverted cone of lantern light, striking blue a great ever-stirring knot of smoke, and a defaulter merry beyond the limits of cockfight etiquette suspended in a basket above the pit, a Welsh main is in progress. Beyond this, a vista of gaming tables may be made out, and further back, a rickety labyrinth of rooms for sleeping or debauchery, all receding like headlands into a mist. The learned D, drawn by the smell of blood in the cockpit, tries to act nonchalant, but what can they expect of him? How is he supposed to ignore this pure edge of blood love? Oh, yawn, yes, of course, seen it all before, birds slashing one another to death, 16 go in, one comes out alive, indeed, and a jolly time betwixt, while the substance we are not supposed to acknowledge drips and flies everywhere. There, learned, calls Mrs. Jello brusquely, we must leave the birds to their work. Beneath the swaying gamester, the general pace of the room keeps profitably hectic. From the labyrinth in back come assorted sounds of greater and lesser ecstasy, along with percussions upon flesh, laughter more and less feigned, furniture a thump, some duetto of viol and Chinese flute, the demented crowing of fighting cocks waiting their moment, cries in concert at some inaudible turn of a card or roll of the fulhams high and low, calls for bitter and three threads rising ever hopeful, like arietas in the shadowed wilderness of rooms, out where the lamps are fewer and the movements deeper with at least one more grade of intent. At length the dog halts, having led them to where, residing half out of doors, framed in cable timbers washed in from a wreck of long ago, an old piece of awning held by a gnawed split, ancient Euphro between her and the sky with its varied menace, sits dark Hepsy, the pythoness of the point. Here, the dog butting at Mason, here is the one you must see. Instantly, Mason concludes, as he will confess months later to Dixon, that it all has to do with Rebecca, his wife, who died 2 years ago this February next. Unable to abandon her, Mason is nonetheless eager to be aboard a ship, bound somewhere impossible. Long voyages by sea being thought to help his condition, described to him as hyperthrenia or excess in mourning. Somehow the learned dog has led him to presume there exist safe conduct procedures for the realm of death, that through this dog-revealed crone he will be allowed at last to pass over and find and visit her and come back, his faith resurrected. That is as much of a leap as can be expected of a melancholic heart. At the same time, he smokes that the learned English D, or Fang as now he apparently wishes to be known, in introducing him thus is pursuing an entirely personal end. Angela said there'd be a package for me. Quotha, am I the evening coach? The two rummage about in the shadows. Look ye, I'll be seeing him later, and I'll be sure to ask, just what you said last time, the dog shaking his head reprovingly. Here, then, a sacrifice, direct from me own meager mess, a bit of stewed hen. 'Tis the best I can do for you today. Peace, Grand Dam, reclaim thy ort. The learned one has yet to sink quite that low. The dog, with an expressive swing of his head, makes a dignified exit, no more than one wag of the tail per step. Your ship will put to sea upon a Friday, Hepsey greets Mason and Dixon. Would that be a bosun's pipe into the ear of either of you gents? Why, the collier sailors believed 'tis bad luck, Dixon replies, as if back at Woolwich before his examiners, it being the day of Christ's execution. Nicely, sir. Thus does your Captain Smith disrespect Christ, fate, St. Peter, and the god Neptune. And withal, there's not an insurancer in the kingdom, from Lloyd's on down, who'll touch your case for less than a sum you can never, as astronomers, possibly afford. Yet if we be dead, Dixon points out, the Royal Navy absorbing the cost of a burial at sea, what further expenses might there be? You are independent of a family, sir? Incredible! Why, you must be a very scryeress. Dixon, having already spied, beneath her layers of careful decrepitude, as he will later tell Mason, a shockingly young woman hard at work, with whom, country lout that he is, he can't keep from flirting. But Mason is now growing anxious. Are we in danger, then? What have you heard? Silently, she passes him a soiled broadside sheet, upon which are printed descriptions of varied services and the fees therefor. What's this? You won't do curses? My insurance? Prohibitive. She cackles as the young fancy the old to cackle. I believe what you seek is under intelligence, naval. Half a crown? If you insist. Dixon? What? You want me to put in half of that? We can't very well charge this to the society, can we? Do I shame you, sir? Hepsey, too pert by decades. Oh, all right, Mason digging laboriously into his purse, sorting out coins and mumbling the amounts. Dixon looks on in approval. You spend money like a very Geordie. He means no harm, lass, beaming, nudging Mason urgently with his toe, as bullies shift about in the dark and boats wait with muffled oars to ferry them against their will over to a life they may not return from. The smell of the great anchorage, smoke, pitch, salt, and decay, sweeps in fitfully. Sirs, attend me, the coins having silently vanished. Since last year, the year of marvels, when Hawk drove Conflans upon that lee shore at Quiberon Bay, the remnants of the Brest fleet have been understandably short of elan or esprit or whatever they style that stuff over there, excepting now and then, among the captains of smaller frigates, souls as restless to engage in personal tactics as disposed to sniff at national strategy. Morman, Le Chiselle, Saint-Foe, mad dogs all, any of them and others likely at any time to sail out from Brest, indifferent to risk, tête-à-tête as ever with the end of the world, seeking new objects of a resentment inexhaustible. Oh, dear, Mason clutching his head. Suppose we sail upon some other day, then. Mason, pray you, 'tis the age of reason, Dixon reminds him. We're men of science. To us must all days run alike, the same number of identical seconds, each preceding in but one direction, irreclaimable. If we would have omens, why, let us recall that the astronomer's symbol for Friday is also that of the planet Venus herself. A good enough omen, surely. I tell you, the young impostress merrily raising a finger, French frigates will be where they will be, day of the week be damned, especially Saint-Foux, with La Changayenne. You know of the École de Piraterie at Toulon? Famous. He has lately been appointed to the Kidian chair. Mason and Dixon would like to stay, the one to fuss and the other to flirt, but as they now notice, a considerable queue has formed behind them. There are gamesters in trouble, sweethearts untrue, sailors with no one to bid them adieu, roistering fops and the Mast Pond Brigade, all impatient to chat with the Sibylline maid, singing, "Let us go down to Hepsey's tonight. Maybe tonight she'll show us the light. Maybe she'll cackle, and maybe she'll cry, but for two and a kick she won't spit in your eye." She warned Ramilly sailors, "Beware of the bolt, and the Corsica bound of Paoli's revolt. From lottery tickets to history's end, she's the miserable, bug-bitten sailor's best friend, singing, "Let us go down," etc. "Nice doing business with you boys. Hope I see yous again," with an amiable nod for Dixon. Back at the cockfights, Fender Belly Bodine comes lurching across their bow, curious. So what'd she have to say? Something about crazy frigate captains sailing out of Brest is all either of them can remember by now. Just what she told my Mauve, and for free. Good, we'll have a fight, gents. And if it's Le Chiselle, we'll have a stern chase, too. Back on old HMS Inconvenience, we wasted many a day and night watching that fancy counter get smaller by the minute. And when he'd opened far enough from us, it pleased him to put out the lantern in his cabin as if to say, "Tout fini, time to frapper le sac." Skipper saw that light go out. He always muttered the same thing. "The dark take you, Le Chiselle, and might you as readily vanish from my life." And then we'd slacken sail and come about, and the real work would begin, beating away, unsatisfied once more, against the wind. Poor topman Bodine, pausing to squeeze the nearest rondures of a young Pole who has shimmered in from some opium dream in the vicinity. Like Hepsi, Mauve is far from what she pretends. Most men are fooled into seeing a melancholy waif, when in reality she's the most cheerful of little butter biscuits, who has escaped looking matronly only thanks to that constant exertion demanded by the company of sailors. She and Hepsi, in fact, share quarters in Portsea, as well as a wardrobe noted, even here upon the point, for its unconsidered use of printed fabrics. "She's a wonderful old woman's, Hepsi," says Mauve. "Fortunes have been won, heeding her advice, as lost, ignoring it. She tells you beware, why, she has reckoned your odds and found them long. She is Lloyd's of Portsmouth, believe her." Later, around dawn, earnestly needing a further word with Hepsi or the dog, Mason can find no trace of either, search as he may. Nor will anyone admit to knowing of them at all, let alone their whereabouts. He will continue to search, even unto scanning the shore, as the Seahorse gets under way at last on Friday, 9 January, 1761. Chapter 4. Had it proved of any help that the Reverend had tried to follow the advice of Epictetus, to keep before him every day death, exile, and loss, believing it a condition of his spiritual contract with the world as given? When the French sail came a twinkling, with never quite invisible death upon the whirr, fore and aft, with no place at all safe, and only the unhelpful sea for escape, amid the soprano cries of the powder monkeys, the smell of charred wood, the muzzle's iron breath, how had these daily devotions, he now wondered, ultimately ever been of use? How in the snug shambles of the Seahorse? To the children, he remarks aloud, "Of course, prayer was what got us through." "I should have prayed," murmurs Cousin Ethelmer, to Tenebry's mild astonishment. Since appearing in the doorway during a difficult bit of double backstitch filling 2 days ago, returned from college in the Jerseys, he has been otherwise all boldness. "Not seized a match? Not gone running up and down the deck screaming and lighting guns as you went, cousin?" The twins consult each the other's phiz, pretending to be stricken. Ethelmer smiles and amiably placates the Reverend, and less certainly Mr. Lespark, his own uncle, as if to say, "We are surrounded by the pious, and their well-known wish never to hear of anything that sets the blood a-racing." Bree looks away, but keeps him in the corner of her eye, as if to reply, "Boy, blood may race as quietly as it must." Mr. Lespark made his fortune years before the war, selling weapons to French and British, settlers and Indians alike. Knives, tomahawks, rifles, hand cannons in the old Dutch style, grenades, small bombs. "Trouble yourself not," he liked to assure his customers, "over diameter. If there are account books in which casualties are the units of exchange, then, so it seems to Ethelmer, his uncle is deeply in arrears." Ethelmer has heard tales of past crimes, but can hardly assault his host with accusations. Everyone knows, that is, considering Uncle Wade as some collection of family stories everyone remembers. Some adventures have converged into a saga that is difficult to reconcile with the living uncle, who sends him bank drafts on whims inscrutable that catch the nephew ever by surprise, frequents the horse races in Maryland, actually once fed apples to the great Salim, and these days doesn't mind if Ethelmer comes along to visit the stables. At the late autumn meet, gaily dressed young women, fancier than he thought possible, had waved and smiled, indeed, come over bold as city cats to engage Ethelmer in conversation. Though young, he was shrewd enough to smoke that what they were after was his plainness, including an idea of his innocence, which they failed to note was long, even enjoyably, departed. "He wants what?" Mason nodding with a sour smile. "Out of our expenses? Shall it leave us enough for candles and soap, do you guess?" No one's sure, Captain Smith having not himself appeared before the council. Rather, his brother came and read them the captain's letter. £100 apiece? £100 guineas? Hey, that suggests they expect someone to come back with a counteroffer. As it isn't us, who would that be? It comes down to the Royal Society or the Royal Navy. As Mason has heard it, the council milled all about, like domestic fowl in perplexity, repeating, "Proportional share," in tones of outrage. "Proportional share?" Leaving this post-captain the right to lay it out, as he calls it, at his pleasure. Some captain. Step away from a privateer, by God. Aggrieved voices echoing in the great stairwell. Silver ringing upon silver. Sugar loaves and assorted biscuits, French brandy and coffee. Stick flourishes, motes of wig powder jigging by the thousands in the candlelight. Immediately raising a particular suspicion, unworthy of this captain, goes without saying, and yet not to be easily distinguished from petty extortion. Quite the sort of behavior Lord Anson's forever on about eradicating. And other remarks in the same line, reports Mason. They were just able at last to appoint a committee of two to wait upon Lord Anson himself, who took the time to inform them that in the Royal Navy, a ship of war's captain is expected to pay for his own victualling. "Really," said Mr. Mead, "I didn't know that, my lord. Are you quite... I didn't mean that. Of course you're sure, but rather..." His thought being, endeavored Mr. White, that all this time we'd rather imagined that the Navy... Alas, gentlemen, one of many sacrifices necessary to that strange servitude we style command, replied the First Lord. Howbeit, 'twill depend largely on how much your captain plans to drink, and how many livestock he may feel comfortable living among. Hardly do to be slipping in goat shit whilst trying to get 10 or 12 guns off in proper sequence, sort of thing. At the same time, we cannot have our frigate captains adopting the ways of street bullies, and this approach to one's guests, it does seem a bit singular. We'll have Stevens or someone send Captain Smith a note, shall we? Invoking gently my own poised thunderbolt, of course. Oh, dear, Captain Smith upon the quarterdeck in the winter's grudged sunlight, the letter fluttering in the breeze from the direction of London, somewhere among a peaked convoy of clouds. A steady mutter as of displeasure on high. And yet I knew it, didn't I? Misunderstood. Far from any extortion scheme, it had rather been the captain's own expectation, the fancy of a heart unschooled in guile, that they would of course all three be messing together, day upon day, the voyage long, in his quarters, drinking Madeira, singing catches, exchanging sallies of wit and theories about the stars. How else? He being of such a philosophical leaning and so starved for discourse, it never occurred to him that other arrangements were even possible. I assumed, foolishly, that we'd go in equal thirds, and meant to ask but your share of what I hope to be spending out of my personal funds upon your behalf, not to mention that buying for three at certain chandleries would have got me a discount. What matter? Best of intentions, gentlemen, no wish to offend the First Lord. Our great circumnavigator, after all, my hero as a lad. We regret it, sir, Dixon offers. Far too much whim-wham. Mason brings his head up with a surprised look. Saintly of you, considering your screams could be heard out past the Isle of Wight. Now, previously unconsulted, I am expected to join this love feast. Dixon and the captain, as if in conspiracy, beam sweetly back till Mason can abide no more. Very well, though someone ought to have told you, Captain, of that rutabagous anemia which afflicts lensmen as a class. The misunderstanding then should never have arisen. Gracious of you, Mr. Mason, cries Dixon heartily. Most generous, adds the captain. 'Tis arranged at last that they will be put in the lieutenant's mess, which is financed out of the ship's account, that is, by the Navy, and take their turns with the other principal officers in dining with the captain, whose dreams of a long, uneventful voyage and plenty of philosophic conversation would thus have been abridged even had the Le Grand never emerged above the horizon. On the 8th of December, the captain has an express from the Admiralty ordering him not to sail. Furthermore, he informs Mason and Dixon, Ben Coulon is in the hands of the French. I see no mention of any plans to retake the place soon. I am sorry. I knew it, Dixon walking away, shaking his head. We may still make the Cape of Good Hope in time, says Captain Smith. That'll likely be our destination if and when they cut the orders. No one else is going there to observe, Mason says. Odd, isn't it? You'd think there'd be a team from somewhere. Captain Smith looks away, as if embarrassed. Perhaps there is, he suggests, as gently as possible. As they proceed down the channel, aye, and that's the tail of the bolt, a sailor informs them, where the Romii went down but the year February, losing 700 souls. They were in southwest weather, the sailing master could not see. He gambled as to which headland it was, mistaking the bolt for Ramehead, and lost all. This is league for league the most dangerous body of water in the world, complains another. Sands and streams, banks and races, I've no peace till we're past the start point and headed for the sea. Can this lad get us out all right? Oh, young Smith's been around forever. Collier, sailor. If he's alive, he must have learned somewhat. Passing the start point at last, the coxcomb of hilltops to starboard, the ship leaning in the up-channel wind, the late sun upon the heights, more brilliant gold and blue than either landsman has ever seen. The cold of approaching night carrying an edge, the possibility that by morning the weather will be quite brisk indeed. Sumatra, sing the sailors of the Seahorse, where the girls all look like Cleopatra, and when you're done you'll simply barter her. For yet another twice as hot, tra la 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 la.